Thanks for tuning to Digital Voices Podcast, where we chat digital transformation, challenges and opportunities across healthcare and life sciences. And now, your host, Ed Marks.
Great having you back to Digital Voices, where we talk all things digital transformation related to health and life sciences. And I'm really excited to introduce you to a good friend of mine. Her name's Jane. I'm going to let her really tell her own story here in a couple minutes, but we're really going to talk about digital transformation from the point of view of the nexus of technology and healthcare. And so it'll be really insightful because Jane has a very, very unique background. So I first met Jane. Jane, I'm trying to think, like, it was early 2000s. We were both on a HIMSS national committee. And we just connected because we're all like trying to do the good things in healthcare and get involved and help out and network. Dan D, it reminds me to ask you, you know, as a millennial, when you meet other people, like when I met Jane, I was very intentional, like, hey, this is someone that has a lot of knowledge, has a lot to say, someone I want to stay connected with. And indeed, thanks to social media, I have. Dan, what about you and your cohorts? Like when you meet other people, are you intentional about, hey, I want to stay connected with this person? How does it work for you?
Yeah, so I usually give anyone who I meet who's interesting a follow on Instagram or Facebook or LinkedIn. They don't always follow me back, but I always make sure to stay connected.
Yeah, that's great because you never know when that relationship will be important on a personal level, a professional level. And it's great too. So for Jane, it's just to follow her career. You know, she launched off into her own and has been operating her own business for a long time and very successful. So anyways, let's just jump right in. So yeah, Jane, welcome to the show and tell us a little bit about some of the music. 'Cause that's like our number one question. What kind of music do you like to listen to?
Man, it's very eclectic. I'm sure a lot of people feel the same way, but music is really part of life and love, I think. And I love to cook, so there's always music going on with the slow food cooker. I grew up with a dad who loved Benny Goodman and jazz and Charles Mingus. My dad was pretty edgy for a Greatest Generation guy. And then I grew up outside of Detroit. So of course it was Motown through my DNA. And my zip code becoming my music code as I grew. And I still love great old Motown, Smokey and the original Supremes, etc. And Marvin Gaye, of course. And then now, over time, more classical. I love big symphonies, Haydn and Mendelssohn, the grand ones. Later, sort of the last 20 years, getting more into country folk like Emmylou Harris. And then I'm even an avid follower of a band called the Fab Four. And this is through my husband who grew up outside of New York City. And Jimmy Vivino has been the arranger for Conan O'Brien forever. You'll see him. He plays every instrument in the world. Anyway, plays with Will Lee, who was the tall, blonde, skinny bassist for Letterman. And there are five guys who do Beatles music live. Pure Beatles sound. It's amazing. So we follow the Fab Four like people follow the Grateful Dead, although in the pandemic we've missed our Fab Four concerts, but they're coming back in the fall. So I mean, it's everything. And I have to say, Beatles, like if this was Desert Island Disc, it would probably be, you know, Beatles White Album.
No, I love it. I can relate to all that music. And yeah, it makes for a greater experience, right, when you have cross-genre musical taste instead of just, you know, one particular one.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool. And tell us about your life mission or your mantra. I think maybe you might have alluded to it already in your description of music, but tell us, you know, sort of what's your driver?
I have to say, and again, stemming from my parents, you know, really love is the killer app. And I didn't make that up. That's an old book. Title from like 2003, so it's almost 20 years old, but it was from Saunders, who was involved in the early Yahoo founding, and it was about your network being, you know, your tribe. And you and I, you know, like we do go back to 20 years, I think, you know, when the internet was new in healthcare, right? We were looking at, you know, the early open internet, like just post CompuServe Prodigy, America Online, we're of that era. And, but it was always about connecting, right?
Yeah.
And networking. So yeah, that's really how I lead. I don't burn bridges. And to your point with Dan earlier, you know, that Rolodex, that digital Rolodex of life has really paid off for me with that attitude over years. Because a lot of my client work are clients who moved on to company after company after company. And it, my own firm has grown organically that way with my clients moving, but me staying doing the same thing. So it's kind of a lesson in how do you be that kind of entrepreneur where you grow your network organically through love and really good service, trying to exceed expectations along the way, but learning with clients and being humble with them.
No, I it's great. You know, I was just taking some notes because you hit on so many great things that we could spend the rest of the time talking about. You know, it's about relationships. It's about love. It's about service beyond expectations. And that has to be one of the reasons why you've had your own business for over 30 years now. As a health economist, an advisor, a blogger, you've been blogging longer, about the time that blogs first emerged, again, back around the time that we first met, longtime blogger, obviously super successful. So that's amazing, right? For anyone to have that longevity, that also that speaks to the type of person you are.
I think being committed to lifelong learning keeps you fresh and young, and having friends from all over, cross silo, cross age, cross culture, keeps you fresh and learning, and again, humble. So I think lifelong learning now, especially we learned in the pandemic, if you couldn't pivot and learn, whether it was new technologies or learn how to bake sourdough bread or learn how to be faithful and prayerful when you couldn't get to church or mosque or synagogue, we all had to become learners in the last couple of years.
Yeah. No, this is good stuff. I almost want to just stop and just talk about this sort of stuff. Tell us a little bit about your story then. So I know that you had sort of a corporate background, but then you launched on your own. Did you think it would go 30 years? I mean, tell us your story, how you got to where you are today how it all happened.
It's so interesting, Ed. Whenever I'm asked this question, I just muse about, you know, how did I get here, right? The old David Byrne song, right? How did I get here? In any case, you know, same as it ever was, right? I grew up in Michigan. I went to University of Michigan for all of my education, first economics undergrad and journalism. So I took writing. There are a lot of writers in my larger family. So the Saracen with an H, the S-O-H-N, you will find Saracens at NPR, at the Oregonian in Oregon, at the Stars and Stripes newspaper, and now and my nephew at the University of Michigan working for MLive. But there's a writer's gene in my family. So I'm not a writer by trade, but I'm a writer by genes. And that's why I'm able to write as much as I do. It's just a gift that way through family. Yeah. But economics has been the passion from undergrad. And then I took time off to do market research in media, one of my first jobs, and then economics in the Michigan Gas Company in the energy era of, you know, liquid natural gas and solar energy and stuff. And then my mom had been ill for many years and doing well, except for the last couple of years. And so I learned a lot about the explanation of benefits that my father was getting from Blue Cross of Michigan. My mother was in a labor union, so it was very cool because she paid for very little of her care. But I saw what it actually cost, well, what was charged, not what it cost, on the EOB. And long story short, I said to my father, who was a businessman, who the heck's paying for this? Because we're not. We're still in the great house that I grew up in, blah, blah. And he said, insurance. And I, what does a 22-23-year-old know about health insurance back then anyway?
Yeah.
So I went back to University of Michigan because I was really curious about how healthcare gets paid for, and it captured my imagination. And I kind of channeled my mother, who had passed away from them, thinking, you know, Mom, you gave me a gift to ask about this. So anyway, I went back to grad school, became a health economist, and worked 10 years in big firms. Accounting-based firms when there was still a big eight. You remember the names, yes. Ernst & Winnie,
yes.
Touche Ross, and now Touche's Deloitte. And long story short, moved to Philly after grad school, became a healthcare consultant with a lovely firm then called Health Systems. It was a boutique firm, got acquired by a big firm, and then fell in love with the man I'm still married to all these years later, Robert, who's an international banker. And we moved to London. And so I cut my teeth on single-payer healthcare when Margaret Thatcher was prime minister with the NHS, and worked for Touche Ross in the city of London, the Square Mile, as it's called, while Robert worked there in one of the banks. And that was an incredible, you know, growth curve for me. So first moving to Philly, growth curve when DRGs came in, then going to London, working in single payer and in the private sector, worked on one of the private sector rehab facilities that Boy George was put in once. So, I mean, it was a very colorful life we had in London, and moved home. And eventually, at that point, came up for partnership in one of the big firms. And I wasn't a mom yet. And I decided that life wouldn't be for me, given the vision I had for the kind of mom I wanted to be, with my husband traveling globally and me traveling too. But I made a huge decision to pull out of the big consulting environment and start Think Health again when the internet was pre-open. So again, three accounts, CompuServe, Prodigy, AOL, cost over $100 a month to have those three accounts. Today we go online thinking it's free, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've been part of that world, the World Wide Web, early on in the O'Reilly world. And long, long story short, started my company on a couple of projects when AT&T divested into the Bell operating companies. And I worked with different phone companies to figure out what they should do in healthcare. And that was my first big, big project on my own. And then from then on, you know, it's just grown like Topsy. So here we are today, open internet and knowing each other all these years and digital being everything.
Yes. Yeah. Who would have thought, right, when we first were together? So, you know, again, these conversations are not highly scripted. So some things that you said caught my attention as well. And that's the whole international experience. So clearly you experienced a great benefit. What would your counsel be to others about trying to get some international experience?
It's everything. And it's so important to me that, in fact, my husband and I became Italian citizens a few years ago through his grandfather's immigration story. That's a whole other podcast. But we're now European citizens. And that's been transformational because in Europe, I'm covered by the GDPR for privacy. And I'm a health citizen, and I use the phrase health citizen a lot now. I even wrote a book last year called Health Citizenship based on this revelation that I have. Because when I'm sitting in Philadelphia, as I am right now, because I can't get back to Belgium until about September, where we have an apartment, not in Italy, in Belgium, but that's the beauty of Europe. I'm covered. You know, I don't have to worry about medical debt when I'm in Brussels or Rome or, well, it used to be London, but because of Brexit, that's no longer Europe, that Europe Union. So in any case, international gives you all kinds of growth opportunities to look at yourself in new ways through new lenses. So there's professional learnings, personal learnings, and then there's the benefit of learning from other cultures. And again, that humility you get through learning and growing, and it keeps you fresh and young. And the food's pretty great too.
Yes. Yeah, no, I'm a big believer as well, and do a lot of travel. And I'm originally from Germany, and
yes.
I always think how it helps shape who I am today. And so I'm always recommend. You know, everyone's always asking, right? Because we're a little bit more mature now. They're asking for career advice, and I'm always like, you got to get some international experience. It'll change you as a person and as a professional. So,
and it's so much easier now with LinkedIn. You know, you meet people. You can meet every people. To Dan's point about saying yes to people asking to connect, to me at this moment, and this could change a year from now, LinkedIn is the jam. Like, you got to keep your LinkedIn bright and new and current, because you meet the best interesting people every week. I'm making new friends. So it's cool.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. Yeah, and actually, I had someone reach out today from one of my favorite cities in Europe, in Bern, Switzerland. And she had stumbled upon my book, and she's doing some work at a health system there. And she's like wanting to talk. And I was like, of course I'm willing to talk, you know, anything we can do to help each other and help, you know, change people's lives anywhere in the world. So no, good stuff. So let's talk more about your company now. So Think, tell us, I'm sure that's for something. Tell us what that stands for. And then I want to hear more about your book as well. So tell us about Think.
Thank you. So when I started Think-Health, Think is capitalized, T-H-I-N-K. T stands for technology, H health, I information, N networks, and K knowledge, -health. And that is really the action verb of what I do for a living. It's not me just thinking, it's me inspiring, supporting, enabling my clients to be quiet for a little while and think about the future. So most of what I do is planning. Lately, and I have had this conversation three times earlier today, we're doing a lot of scenario planning right now because of uncertainties in the general economy, about inflation, uncertainties about healthcare coverage. People didn't know who was going to pay for their COVID test or COVID care. So many people avoided care. So of course, there's a strong economics theme through my planning and informing clients. And then uncertainty about, say, things like trust, not just trust with the vaccine, but now with vaccine passports, how are we going to safely get back to work? And a lot of people don't want to share data, even like their temperature during COVID, which was an important metric. So because we saw with like the connected thermometer, we could actually see areas through the GPS of the thermometer, the internet of thermometer, where cases were spiraling and spiking. So in any case, I help people think through the future. That's really, people don't know really what I do for a living. People, clients across the health ecosystem will engage me to help them either on, you know, an hour a month retainer, or to do a project, really doing a scenario planning for a new product area, a new service, or brainstorm, you know, wild cards, the unthinkables, the what if. And it used to be bioterrorism, like anthrax was a what if, or a pandemic was a what if. No more. Those are just now uncertainties. And there are other wild cards that are hard to think about. So that's what I do for my day job. And then all this other stuff, you know, to do thought leadership and sharing of what I know.
Yeah,
I know.
So you're prolific on Twitter. So for those who are in the Twitterverse, they should look you up. What's your Twitter handle, Jane?
Yeah, I'm Healthy Thinker, which comes from the company Think Health. So I'm Healthy Thinker on Twitter.
Great information that you put out. So talk to us about your book. So in between helping all these companies with brainstorming, scenario planning, future proofing, you found time to write this book on health citizenship. So tell us a little bit about the thesis of that book.
Yeah, so Health Citizenship was published last September, so 7 months into the pandemic. So February 29th, last year was a leap year, I took my last trip from Scripps, where I saw Eric Topol in the morning, and in the afternoon gave a talk to Sharp Healthcare about the future of consumers. And at that talk at Sharp, the CEO disintermediated me first by telling everybody to be mindful about their use of a word, a phrase I never heard before, PPE, because their mask and gown and disposable outlet came out of a place called Wuhan, China, that was disrupted their supply. This was February 29th. You know, my mouth to God's ears. Yeah. This is the truth, and that's where I cut my first memory about COVID. after hugging, you know, 300 doctors who I've known for years working, you know, collegially, flew home to Philly. My husband was in Brussels or in Europe at the time, our apartment in Brussels. And by March 18th, I was watching Rachel Maddow at 9 p.m. Eastern, and she had Lori Garrett on, who writes about pandemics. And Lori looked in the camera as I'm looking at you right now and said, think about who you want to be with and where you want to be for the next many months, because you're going to be stuck. And I called Robert a couple hours later when it was about 6 a.m. in Brussels, and yeah. I said, you got to get home, honey. And so he got home that Friday, the 20th, the last day Belgium airports allowed flights out. Otherwise, he would have had to take a train to London, which was actually the plan, but he did get out of Brussels. And anyway, long story short, that was sort of the genesis of me working from March 1st, 2020 for 6 months, gathering data from Nielsen and Harris and Gallup and HIMSS and Consumer Tech Association and all of my touch points for data to figure out what's going on with people, consumers, health citizens at home. How are we digitally transforming? And then who are we going to be, probably, with my prognosticating hat on? So by the end of 6 months, I had enough signals where I identified five big trends that were the sort of the pillars of my book, and then ending up with the question, will Americans choose to be health citizens in that wearing the mask is a sign of love for you and for me, vaccinating, physical distancing, etc. And the jury is out, I have to say, soberly, all these months later, that about this question, do Americans embrace the idea of health citizenship the way my European peers do, who bought into to that? So that was a sobering analysis, but, you know, I'm doing a lot of work based on that research. And then previous to that book, I used the word health citizen in the tagline to my previous book, which was called Health Consuming, which really tracked the history of healthcare consumerism in America and the state of the fact that one in every $5 in American households goes to healthcare. A lot of people don't realize when you add everything up, it's a buck a five from the dinner table for the median income American. And so it's no wonder the likes of Walmart and CVS and Walgreens and Apple and Amazon are, quote, disrupting, because this is what we trust. This is what we know. This is where we are. And so to me, it was all, you know, predicted and in that first book, and now we're living it.
Fascinating. And I should take advantage of this situation on behalf of our listeners and ask you some futurism questions, if that's the right wording. So where do you think, because I've thought a lot about it too, like with the disruptors that are coming in that you mentioned, retail, big tech, what do you think, how would you counsel your average C-suite of an average hospital? Should they be taking action? Should they be alarmed? What would you recommend? Because what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be alarmed. I would just try to get smart. I mean, take a deep breath, because this is that Herman Kahn, no relation to me, but spelled the same way, K-H-N, who conceived of the nuclear bomb. We have to think the unthinkable. And the unthinkable is something either someone from your institution or Cleveland Clinic said a few years ago, which is you should plan 3 years from now to have 50% of the beds you operate. What will that look like? Because what I am working on with different companies across the ecosystem, from, you know, a smart refrigerator and big food company to a car company to healthcare and a pharma, is the home as the health hub. We're going to move acute to home. You're already doing it. Lots of people are, Intermountain, et cetera. Philips pivoted during the pandemic, not just to make ventilators, but, you know, to start to counsel clients to move care home, and others. So, I mean, and consumers kind of like the home as a health hub now. We really figured out food is medicine. The smart toilet is getting more traction outside of Korea and Japan now. So I really think we look as much now to the Consumer Electronics Show in January as we do to HIMSS or AHIP or any other place, because we really have to think about the consumer as that underutilized resource, amping up health literacy, digital literacy, broadband to the home, to the N of one, not just the last mile, and then turbocharge self-care the way it can be and should be, because ultimately I'm all about lowering costs and improving quality and enchantment. And that is the
very insightful. So this is gold for our listeners. Thank you for Jane for freely sharing those things, because I'm in agreement with you. What about you're touching on it a little bit, but maybe a little deeper on patient experience. So any thoughts about, you know, we have a lot of high expectations now from other industries from a consumer experience point of view. What are you thinking, or how would you advise, you know, health systems or payers about patient experience?
Absolutely. Well, as we were saying, people are getting used to these new retail experiences, and this is what they're looking for in healthcare, asking why not? So now that I have to self-care and pay more out of pocket, which is a huge driver, I should be the customer now as a real health consumer. So we're looking to the wisdom of designers, the people who know how to do that great at Apple or Procter and Gamble or any number of places. And so my great advice to CXOs in healthcare is get a designed, mindful person on staff, or if you can't afford a full-time equivalent, get a design firm to sort of consult with you ongoing to look at the 360 patient experience, or if you're starting a new service, particularly one that will be borne financially by consumers out of pocket, make sure you think about the consumer's values and value. So you have the two V's and you have to keep those in mind.
If you're listening and you're from a provider, payer, other health life science organization, and you're not taking any action, you need to look up Jane, because Jane, what you're sharing is right on. I agree with you completely. It's time, not to panic, but to look at, assess the situation and take action. But you shouldn't not take any action. So my last question, and then I'll turn over to you for any final thoughts, is why do you think that there's been maybe a reluctance by some organizations to take sort of action? You know, because at least my hypothesis is that we're not moving fast enough.
No, we're not. The world's moving fast, and COVID only accelerated not just digital transformation, but really people understanding the person, knowing about health citizenship. More and more people understand what public health means. That just like with the Zika crisis in Miami, I remember there was a quarantine in certain zip codes, and I was thinking, what does the mosquito know about zip codes? Right? To fly into Boca from South Miami Beach. I mean, come on. So, I mean, this is where we are now. Like, we are connected with each other. And so there's a fear of what I don't know. And that's why we hire smart staff and bring talent up to snuff and work with people like you who are very forward-looking and others in the marketplace and get smart. You know, when you learn, and this is why I talked about lifelong learning before, the world's going to change. The pace is faster and faster. And you either keep up and keep ahead, know where the puck's going, my old Detroit roots, go where the puck's going, or find a new career path. And I'm serious about this, because if you don't keep up, you're done. And I always say, you know, when I stop blogging, if you see me stop blogging, I'm making wine in Italy at that point. And that day may come. I'm not there yet. I'm still resilient. But you do have to keep learning and keep smart people around you who challenge you, right? Yeah. So you can't have that groupthink anymore. Diversity really pays off. Men, women, gay, straight, race, ethnicity. I mean, this is the world now.
Yeah, I completely agree. So, wow, this has been fantastic, Jane. I just sit back and I'm like, man, I wish we were still on a committee together and I get to see you and interact more often. You're getting me all fired up as well. I'll leave you with the last word. You know, we covered a lot of topics, but maybe there's something we missed or something you want to double down on. What else, you know, would you like to to say to our audience, share with our audience?
You know, I'm just very grateful that we're coming through the pandemic. I think we've learned a lot. We should have learned about humility. We should have taken time to love on our loved ones more, and appreciate the many blessings we all have, because we do have them if we're listening to this call. I promise you, there are so many people worse off. I think we need to just live with more grace and give each other room and space to be kind, because it's been tough and we all leave traumatized from this thing. Wherever we sit, it doesn't matter where you are, it's been hurtful, it's been hard. So I think just let's live with more grace with each other, and slow down and cook more slow food.
Yeah.
And just, you know, savor life, because it is such a gift. And that we're working in this field is also a great gift. So I appreciate that. And I appreciate you letting me share some ideas with everybody.
Oh my gosh, it was so, so, so good. I'll just end with that. Thank you so much, Jane. What a blessing to have you. And wish you nothing but success. Look up Jane. I'm telling you, if the things that she touched on, you're not doing things about it progressively in your organization, look her up. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks, Dan.
Hi, this is John Lynn from the Healthcare IT Today podcast. If you like the latest rumors, insights, and happenings in healthcare IT, you'll enjoy hearing my colleague Colin Hung and myself debate and share the latest happenings from the world of healthcare IT. Find the latest episodes or dig into our archive at healthcareittoday.com or search for Healthcare IT Today on your favorite podcast application or YouTube. When it comes to healthcare technology, we love this stuff, and we can't wait to have you join in on the discussion of everything health IT.
Thank you for listening to Digital Voices Podcast with Ed Martin. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe on your preferred streaming service and leave a rating and review. And most importantly, thanks again for listening.